Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. This chant that we just completed, called a gatha, little verse, a Buddhist verse, an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma, is rarely met with even 100,000 million kalpas. Now we can see it and hear it, accept and maintain it. Now we unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth. So in this gatha, they're talking about very, very, very unusual appearance of Buddha in the world. Not for 100,000 million kalpas. This is beyond an infinite amount of time. Timeless. 100,000 million kalpas. Appeared an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma. And now we can see and hear it. And now we unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth, the Buddha's truth. So this is about the Buddha appeared just once in this endless amount of time. And so this is intended, this gatha is intended to introduce whoever is giving a talk. This talk tonight is, it means that who's ever talking tonight, whatever dharma you're going to hear, whatever lecture you're going to hear, it's the same as if Buddha is talking. So it's encouraging the audience to pay attention. And of course, this comes from the time when the audience was the monks in the monastery. So at the start of a talk, whoever is giving the talk on a designated time for a lecture. So we recite this gatha, this chant, which its meaning is an essential part of Buddha's teaching, which is very rarely does the Buddha appear. So this is the message, but it's doesn't mean exactly what it seems to mean, this gatha. We need to understand the meaning of it in a very large sense. It's not about the lecture that's about to happen. It seems like it's saying, okay, everybody pay attention, because it's a rare opportunity. It's not exactly about that. It's not about the lecture that's coming up, and it's not about paying courtesy to the speaker, you know, like, oh, you're about to give this very illuminating once-in-a-million-years, once-in-a-lifetime talk. It's not about that. That's very limited understanding. This chant, this gatha, is about everything we see and hear. Not just what's going to happen tonight. It's about every event in every moment. You know, the smallest amount of time, each moment. The gatha talks about endless time. 100,000 million kalpas. Can't imagine it. But it's actually about this very moment. This infinitesimal small amount of time. So when there is a Dharma talk or a lecture with a speaker and with an audience of listeners, or whenever there is any event with a speaker and a listener, not just tonight in this hall, but any event with a speaker and a listener, then this gatha is true. Then we make it true. Unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth. This gatha is true in any event with a speaker and a listener. And the message is, we should make it true. We should make it true. And we make it true by giving up all ideas about me or I or we. We let those disappear. When we transform the idea of a personal me or a personal we into the universal we, then this gatha can become alive. And then whatever we do or say becomes the perfect dharma. So it's not just about some unusual person appearing on the earth in a brief moment of infinite time. It's about every moment, each of us appearing for each other. That's when we can have the perfect dharma. But what do we mean by that? Perfect dharma. Perfect dharma. Perfect dharma is about selflessness. I think most people understand selflessness as some kind of ultimate ideal, a moral idea, a moral goal, to strive to become selfless. Most people feel they do understand the concept of selflessness and how they can be selfless. And when we talk about being selfless, we can name all the characteristics of being selfless and make a list and talk about it, and it could be perfectly logical. But the problem is we are so stubborn. We humans are so stubborn. We continue to do things and live our lives based on ideas of self. It's a very stubborn concept to let go of. So we say, "I'm listening," or "I am studying," or "I have a question," or "I'm being unselfish." The I always seems to creep in. This is part of our stubbornness. These ideas and these activities are based on concept that we have of ourself. It's a very stubborn idea. But when we can go beyond the idea of me, the listener, or someone else, the speaker, when we can bridge that gap, and at the same time understand that we are temporary beings in 100,000 million kalpas, for a brief moment, temporary beings, and that we are relating to each other in just this small moment of time. And our relationship is not permanent. For a moment of time, we relate to each other. We come as speaker and listener, but we transcend those distinctions. Our relationship is not permanent in that sense. It is tentative, our relationship, because in the next minute or tomorrow, you become the speaker and I become the listener. And then a moment later, we change back. So this relationship is always shifting, always changing. Our relationship is always changing. When we understand that, when we understand that you and me, that we are always changing from listener to speaker and speaker to listener, when we understand that we are transient for a brief moment in this infinite time, then any ideas about me or I or myself can lose their intensity, and we can understand selflessness. This is the meaning of the perfect Dharma. And we, in our thoughts and actions and in our life, can expound this perfect Dharma through selflessness. As the teaching tries to have us understand, we are temporary and tentative beings. Each moment we are a new being. And our relationship is temporary and tentative. We can never, ever meet again just like this. Even if we come together again with each other many times in 100,000 million kalpas, we can never meet in just this way again. So this chant, this gatha, is saying we should not miss this meeting. It will never happen again. We should not take it casually. We should treat it with respect and our full attention when we're with each other, because in a moment it's gone. We should treat each moment of our relationship respectfully and selflessly. In other words, we should not miss each other in this momentary relationship. Pay attention. Don't be distracted. We should not miss each other. This is the meaning of the chant or the gatha that we recited a few minutes ago. So when you meet with someone or discuss something with your friends and relationships, usually your discussion is influenced by the idea of yourself, by the idea of me or I or my story. We always carry around our story, and We're very happy when we have an opportunity to tell our story. Sometimes, for some people, it becomes very urgent. But this is just simply the ego trying to be in control. And it happens because our view of our meeting with each other or our discussion with each other or with someone is not completely understood. The meaning of our meeting with each other is not totally understood. And sometimes, well, this is why meetings and discussions quite often don't work, because we don't understand what's happening in a large sense. We don't understand that we can never meet again just this way. So we need to know in our lives and in our relationships with each other and with everything, we need to know what is going on between us in the real sense. And we can have this understanding of what's really going on when we can let go of ideas or notions of me and I and myself and my story. And we should be humble enough to bow in our mind to each other. We should be humble enough to bow to the other person with our mind, as well as when we put our hands together and physically bow to each other. When Westerners, Americans and Westerners go to Japan, they're very touched by the way people always gassho to each other, constantly. And it's a very moving feeling when you see people continually take a moment to pay their respects in a humble way to each other. Stop for a moment and bow in their minds to another person. This is very moving when we see it. But then we leave Japan and come home and we find we can't do that. We find it uncomfortable and hard to do that in this culture that doesn't understand relationships in that way. So this bowing to each other in the modern world, and it feels very strange because we don't understand its meaning. But here at Kanando, at least, we should do it. When we can bow to anyone with ease and without hesitation, we are bowing to our true nature, more than just one-to-one. We bow to our true nature, to our absolute being. When we do it with ease, with comfort and with humility, then we can understand selflessness. And we can understand interdependency and understand the meaning of our true relationship with each other, which is beyond this temporary getting together. If we talk about interdependency or relate to each other without knowing that it is based on the teaching of everything changes, then our meetings may not go so well. Then we're likely to repeat over and over again the same problems of our ego. It's important to understand that temporary nature of each of our relationships even if we make a sincere effort to have a good meeting and a good discussion, if we don't understand the tentative nature of each meeting as well as its universal nature, and how we should pay full respect to this meeting to make it a unique jewel, we will have problems. We should make each moment, each meeting, each relationship into a jewel. If we don't see our meetings in that way, we are at risk of remaining self-centered. So if we meet someone, even for just a moment, "Oh, good morning, how are you?" We make that meeting into a jewel, not treat it casually. And if we meet for a longer time, 20 minutes, an hour, we are creating a jewel. And we can only create this jewel through selflessness. So interdependency, the Buddha's teaching of interdependency means we should not ignore anything or anyone. We don't treat each other or we don't treat the things of this world in a casual way. We should not treat our relationships in a casual way or in an uncaring and trivial manner. And of course, this means we need to let go of notions of ourself and what it is that we feel we want for ourself. And this dropping off has to take place over and over again. So when we meet with each other and discuss something with each other, we should keep our mind quiet. We should not make noise with our minds. And this is how we express our true nature. So we listen to each other, and we listen to each other's opinions and the opinions of other people, and we observe the way, the various ways that we do things. And we listen and observe with modesty and without judging. We acknowledge each other, and we acknowledge each other's words, and we acknowledge each other's ways of doing things. And we just simply say, "Okay, Okay. And of course, we have to be careful not to insist that our own way is the right way. And when we give instruction to new people about how to do Zazen, we always advise that if, you know, some discomfort comes up or something starts to itch or something like that, that don't be too quick to scratch it. Don't be too quick to relieve your discomfort. Pay attention to it, acknowledge it, stay with it. This is another way of bowing in Gassho. And if we cannot do this for each other, it means we are having a hard time expressing ourselves. But when we can do it, when we are not so concerned with our own itch, we can do it, and then everything we do will be okay. So, for me to speak this way is pretty easy, and for anybody to be here and speak this way, it's pretty easy. Looks pretty easy, just some preparation, you know, easy. But actually, to do it fully, to do it completely is not so easy. We have to work pretty hard to avoid old habits. But I think here at Kanando, I think we are all doing pretty well because we are practicing Zazen together. And maybe we don't know exactly what we're doing. But anyhow, we are practicing. And that is the main thing. So, if while you're sitting, you discover you've been daydreaming, or you're distracted, or you have started to explore a very exciting idea, and then you notice what you've done with your mind, and you have some remorse, and you say, "Oh, I should not have let that happen." But of course, by then it's already too late. It's happened. We can't go back and unthink it or unfeel it. So we let it alone and let it go away by itself. And we come back to ourself, to our quiet, empty mind. We continue to come back to ourself, our quiet mind. So if you take this approach and have this understanding, your practice will be quite fine, despite any noisiness that may appear. Your practice will be fine, even though from time to time you may say, "Oh, I don't, my mind is so distracted that it's not so good." If you come back to yourself continually, your practice is fine. Come back to yourself with a quiet mind so that you're ready for the next relationship. We talk about emptiness. This practice talks about emptiness, and we initially feel that some kind of void, must be some kind of void. There's nothing there, emptiness. But the practice of emptiness actually means we don't ignore anything. We acknowledge all things equally without attachment. This is emptiness. And if you understand your life this way, you will understand why this practice is so important. And how necessary it is to be humble and caring in our relationships with each other, the relationships which are constantly changing. And we don't want to miss a moment with each other. So we come to each relationship with a quiet and humble and attentive mind. This is our practice. Does anybody have a question? Yes, Lee.
If somebody treats you in a demeaning way or a disrespectful way, you can be silent, but you can't really seek to have a relationship with someone like that, can you?
You can. We have to be careful not to let someone else's behavior distract us or discourage us from our practice. We do our best. We should do our best to have a positive relationship with everyone, including difficult people. And if it doesn't work this time, well, try it again the next time. So I think it's important not to cut people out of our lives because they are difficult. Let's just continue our respectful mind for each relationship and keep trying. It can be a challenge. Is it Columbine?
I was thinking about, I guess, like, we've talked in the past about how humans kind of can hold a grudge, and like an animal, like say like a cow, would not hold a grudge against somebody. And then I was thinking about like a cow, like they're very like self-oriented in a sense of like, I have to eat, I have to feed my baby. And so I guess my question was sort of like, it seemed like there was some kind of wisdom that animals had, but then that kind of contradicts in thinking about that they are kind of self-oriented, but then other animals are not like that, you know, maybe like ants. They're more for like the whole community. So I guess my question is sort of, do you feel like animals in general are sort of closer to this selflessness sense?
Well, you know, every animal and every insect and every human being, we are all trying to survive. So we eat and we drink and we sleep and we make babies, trying to survive. And each creature, we're an insect, animal, I believe they express selflessness because they have not developed the capacity to see me or I. They just exist according to how they were born. It's we humans who start imagining ourselves as other than how we're born. We develop ideas and fantasies, desires, and we try to control things. So I believe animals are continually expressing selflessness while they simply try to exist and survive and be who they are inherently. But we humans feel we have to do more than simply survive. It's part of humanity. And that's okay, but we have to be careful of how we express that urge to be more than simply have an animal nature. You know, we are creative and we want to do things. That's fine. It's necessary. But we have to be careful how we do it so we can truly create things and not create problems. This is the dilemma, I think, of human nature. This is why I think, spiritual people have appeared in the past, religious leaders, and I think their message is, cool it. Take it easy. But we don't have to tell that to animals. Our speaker last week had a brief expression, which everybody got a laugh out of it, when he said, we human beings are descended from the aggressive apes because the chill apes have disappeared. The chill apes. The chill apes are the ones who don't push themselves. They just go on. It's the other ones who say, I have to be noticed. I think this is what Buddhism is all about. You know, let's learn to cool it. Let's chill. We don't have to be so grasping. Be like the cow. It's interesting to ponder. Thank you.
What about animals or people who cause harm? So there's, I think that there's relationships that, I mean, you could divide it however you wanted to, but there's, I think that you could say that there's some relationships where there's the other entity is causing harm or is capable of that, and there's the other entity is not necessarily. So with animals, I don't know what the parallel would be, but I think that humans are capable of causing harm to others intentionally. How do you handle those relationships?
This is a big question. How do we respond to suffering? Suffering created by another person's actions or words. How do we respond to it when we feel suffering? We can go to war, or we can respond in another way. Going to war will only increase the suffering, but it feels like the easiest thing to do. Striking back, you know, we don't have to think about it. If we are harmed by someone intentionally, the thought of revenge or getting even is so narrow and so simple, we don't have to think about it. So, of course, it has an appeal in that way. But if we think about it, if we consider what's really going on here, do I really want to create more suffering by seeking revenge or seeking to get even? Getting revenge will make me feel good, but in the long run, is that the best thing to do? So these are the kinds of things we have to consider when there is harm created intentionally. How we respond to it. And from the standpoint of our practice, it's a question of who is responding. Is it just me? Just this I? Just this self? Or is it something bigger that is responding? So your question is very vital, very important part of our practice. And when we practice with that question, I think we learn a great deal about who responds to suffering. And it's the study of a lifetime. Thank you.
So I lived in Japan for a few years, and I heard and was, I really started to feel that Buddhism is a part of their culture. And I met these people, I want to understand, I met these people who are almost like invisible. It's almost like their life goes beyond generations. Like they can execute on things from hundreds of years ago that their ancestor decided, like continue the family farm, continue the tradition, or even in a company, just submit themselves to something that was decided in a past life by someone else. So I want to understand, how can they submit their life? It seems powerless in some sense. But is that Buddhism?
You mean you experienced them, you saw them continuing the old traditions?
Well, not just continue, but almost like follow a plan that somebody had decided for 100 years later that will take a few generations to implement, just following that plan, giving their life to that, not really having that, like how we have here that I need to change it or have my own life, not having that mindset.
Well, each culture's way of life is influenced by things that happened in the past. And in this country, we have a way of life that is influenced by, you know, what happened in the 17th century, the 18th century. And even today, we insist on continuing those values. And in other countries, the same thing. Historical events, the remembrance of those historical events carry through into future generations. And little by little, we learn how to refine them and modify them when we understand they need to be modified. So I think what's going on in Japan is the old ways from centuries ago are still there, but things are changing as the community, which in the 15th and 16th century was pretty small, the community is now the whole globe. So we are now sharing our histories. Each culture is sharing its history. And sometimes it creates clashes. But little by little, we have to learn to come up with a common background that we can all follow with each other willingly. So as we learn more about each other in the modern world, because we can communicate easily and we can travel easily, as we learn more about each other and things change, sometimes the changes are troubling for us, sometimes the change, we accept them gratefully. But we're in the middle of that process now, that change. And I think we have to be careful not to judge too quickly some new thing, some new culture that we find. We have to be patient with each other and hope that other cultures are patient with our culture, which has its problems. I think human beings have problems in this world because when they meet each other, their cultures clash. So we have to learn to absorb each other's cultures and accept each other's backgrounds. And we're all conditioned by our history. But in general, people are very open to each other and are willing to learn from each other. And feel nourished by each other. And so with some time and with some patience, I'm optimistic that everything will even out. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you so much for explaining this opening verse. So if I understood you correctly, the first part was talking about how we often don't pay attention. So the second part kind of being a commitment to, I guess, being present so that we are able to hear the speaker. So I was just curious, like my understanding of Buddhism is that it was an oral tradition, so for a long time. So perhaps sutras were written in ways where they were easier to remember because of like rhythm and whatnot. And when we translate the sutras into other languages in modern times, is there room to maybe say them more in just straightforward terms, or is part of presenting it this way, like having to contemplate it, part of understanding the teachings? So like in some way, like could we just say, hey, we don't pay attention, so listen. So I'm just wondering in, you know, today's world, like because we don't have the same requirements of past, like we have, like people can read, like the general population can read, like is there a reason why we couldn't have more just straightforward, even though I enjoy listening to interpretations of old verses?
I think the the most interesting and the most important characteristics of human beings are we like to make discoveries. We like to create. You look at little children before they can speak or think or read, always making discoveries and learning that way through their own effort, seeking and turning over new rocks. And we should not discourage that part of ourselves, not diminish our capacity and our desire to discover, to make discoveries. And if we get too specific, as we become adults, we want things easier and laid out for us. If we become too specific, we won't be able to make discoveries. So our life has to have some questions and some uncertainty and some complexity, which gives us a chance to explore and make discoveries. If it's too explicit, then life becomes just, what's the term, rote? You know, just programmed. So sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes we do need a user manual these days. But for the bigger meaning of our life, we have to make discoveries. And when we do, then we understand something, because it comes to us through our own effort. It's not somebody else's words. It's our own wisdom that's appearing. So this is one of the appeals, I think, one of the appeals of Buddhism and of Zen in this country is that little mysterious, quite poetic. You need to contemplate and dig it out. And I think that's necessary because it's part of who we are. I had your question, that question when I was first starting. I would go to my teacher and say, you never explain enlightenment. I said, and he said, oh, you don't think so? Oh. Then I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what he meant. This is the magic and the beauty of our practice, to unpack the poetry through our own effort. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Kanando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to kanando.org. That's kanando.org.